everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week on this program, we explore different aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. And tonight, I'm really excited about our guest. He's Jim Sparks. He's a UFO experiencer and the author of his new book, The Keepers, An Alien Message for the Human Race, which has just been released by Wildflower Press. Now, before I introduce my guest, let me just give you a little bit of UFO news. Not a lot, because I'm really excited about the guest. I really want to get talking to him. But there's been a lot of UFO activity that I have to tell you about. And just all over the world, in Canada, in New Mexico, in England, and the United States, have all had a bunch of recent sightings. For example, in Canada, let's start with Canada. In January 18th of this year, over the Arctic Ocean, about 9 degrees from the North Pole, Northwest Territories, a pilot and crew of a United Airlines flight from Chicago to Hong Kong saw a flaming ball pass by their aircraft. They said it passed on a flat trajectory, but it appeared to be dropping wreckage. And they estimated the altitude of this object was about 34,000 feet. Don't know what it could be. 1 week later or so, on January 27th, in Manitoba, another witness saw what he called a bright bluish-green colored light that was strobing or pulsating. It was traveling north to south, and it appeared to crash into the ground or vanish on the horizon. He couldn't tell. But on that same day, there were several other sightings in this area, all throughout Manitoba and Quebec. And these sightings actually continued for the next week. In Hibbard, Quebec, on January 31st, a witness described a large, round, typical flying saucer-shaped object with 8 portholes and a bunch of colored lights underneath. He described it as being as big as a house, about 150 feet tall and 60 feet wide. It was green in color and was hovering about 500 feet above the trees. So that's in Canada. Now, there's a lot of other activity going on down in Mexico, actually. On the evening of January 27th, this is just a few days ago, dozens of people informed the local media of Yucatan that they were observing unidentified flying objects, which they described as circular in shape with a bunch of round lights surrounding it. And this was actually captured on video, so it's a pretty exciting case. And what's really interesting is 1 day later, on January 28th, a flight mechanic, Enrique Morales Piedras, was actually on board a Boeing 737 flying between Mexico City and Puerto Vallarta at 9:20 a.m. when he observed, or actually he was taking photographs of the Popocatépetl volcano on his cell phone camera when suddenly the pilot shouted out, look, what's that over there? This is what the airline captain said. And so this flight mechanic, Enrique Morales, pointed his cell phone at it and actually took pictures of this object, which is described as a metallic object, approximately 200 meters away from them. What was really amazing is the audio, they got audio recordings of this incident, and you can hear in the background, traffic, meaning that the onboard collision system actually picked up this object on its radar. So that's Mexico. There's sightings over London, England recently, over Islington to be more specific. Dozens of mysterious orange lights were seen hovering above the sky by numerous witnesses. These objects apparently stopped traffic, and this was on February 2nd, just a few days ago, and there's numerous witnesses who saw this. One witness said it reminded him of the air raid in London back in World War II. So it was a pretty big event. And now also in Arizona, this is interesting, there's activity going on near Winslow Crater. Numerous witnesses have reported seeing a very strange lighted object hovering over the town and apparently circled around the town like 15 times over the town of Loup, L-E-U-P-P, Arizona. And this was just at the end of February. And also, there's apparently another sighting going on in Phoenix. What's really interesting is this is near the anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, which occurred in 1997, so almost 10 years ago, when numerous thousands of residents saw these lights over Phoenix. Well, just recently, numerous residents across Phoenix are seeing lights again, and apparently they have been caught on camera, so this could turn out to be another really exciting case. And the last bit of news I want to share with you is an update on this sighting over Chicago O'Hara Airport. I've been giving you regular updates on this. There was a sighting last year over Chicago O'Hara's airport in which an object described as metallic and circular in shape apparently punched through the clouds and left a hole in the clouds and was observed by airline pilots and air traffic control officers. What's really interesting now is Dan Aykroyd, who is a UFO researcher, claims to have actually made contact with people who filmed this incident, and he claims to have the video footage, which is supposedly very impressive, and he will be releasing this in the future. So it's a pretty exciting development and a lot of stuff going on. But let's get to our guest tonight, Jim Sparks. I'm just really excited to have him on the show tonight. Jim's actually started out as a property developer in, I believe it was Florida, and he began having experiences in the early 1980s. And what's really interesting about Jim Sparks is he's what UFO researchers call a conscious abductee, where probably 75% or 80% or 90% of people who have encounters with ETs, they often have missing time, and a lot of their memories can only be recalled through hypnosis. Whereas our guest tonight apparently has a very strong willpower and is able to remember a lot of his experiences. At least this is the one commonality I've noticed in the people I've interviewed who are able to remember their UFO experiences. They really want to remember. They have a very strong willpower. But at any rate, I'd like to introduce you all to Jim Sparks. Jim, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, it's great being here. Thanks for that elegant introduction.
Oh, I'm really honored to have you on. I remember hearing about your story years ago. Every now and then I'd punch your name into the internet and see if your book had come out yet, and it hadn't, and I had to wait like 3-4 years. But now it's out, and I've read it, and you know, I have to tell you, I'm amazed, because having done research on this subject for a long time, there's just so much in your book that rings true to me. And I've just talked to so many people, and it's just really amazing to have all of these details in sort of one cohesive story, to have one person. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is each person sort of gives one piece of the puzzle, but here you are laying it all out. So it's really refreshing.
Well, thank you. It's been quite a journey.
I can imagine. So, God, how did this happen?
Yeah, really, how do you start? For myself, prior to the mid-80s, as far as I was concerned, I had no clue or any idea at all that abductions took place like, you know, they do. I wasn't up with the subject. Sure, I believe that possibly there were visitors from other worlds, perhaps because the universe is so big and there's so many planets and so many suns, billions and billions, and I thought it'd be silly to think that it couldn't be possible. And I also thought perhaps that maybe we did get a visit from time to time, maybe for science purposes and things of that nature. But I had no clue that people were being pulled. I use the term pulled instead of abducted a lot on the basis that they are, and God knows for how long, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions. And, you know, and it is correct about the memory thing, and I've experienced encounters that were, I've seen other people, mass abductions where towards the end of the abduction, the memory is taken away from them. I think in my case, and I'm starting to become a little more certain as to why I've retained so much,
Right.
And for me, it was I was taken completely by storm, totally by surprise. Had no clue it was coming. It came out of nowhere. It came when I was in my early 30s, almost mid 30s, I should say. Well, early 30s, 33 to 34 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it was completely unexpected. And what I didn't realize at the time was that, and you know, I'd share with you sort of the nature of the way these beings are, but that there was a campaign on a global basis prior to contact to people like me. I just consider myself to be the average person, Preston, but
right.
to world leaders, people in power.
Yeah, there's been a lot of rumors of that, of UFOs contacting world leaders, and I think more than rumors. In some cases.
Exactly. And in my case, I from what I've seen and experienced, that these individuals were granted technologies to clean up the planet, to stop the threat for us annihilating ourselves, be it biological, be it nuclear, be it whatever it may be. In return for us doing that and the ability for cheaper energy or freer energy or free energy in a lot of cases and things of that nature. And unfortunately, what we do and as a human species, these individuals chose on the most part to ignore it and make money with it and make more weapons with it. So The encounters that I had came completely out of the blue without me having any clue that any of that was going on. And there was a campaign, and I'm sure it's still in effect, to, in a sense, contact the average person, sort of work grassroots, work from the ground up, so to speak, because it didn't seem to work that way. And I happened to be one of those people.
Right. You know, I have to agree, because when I first heard about abductions, I heard that there was like 1 in 50 people who had this experience. And I thought, no way.
Yeah.
And I started asking people. I know 50 people. I think everyone does.
Yeah, exactly.
And I asked 50 people.
Put it.
And I found like 5. So that was a lot more than, 1 in 50.
Sure it is. I sometimes can start when these conversations as to, well, how did it exactly start, so on and so forth. And
well, you must have had clues in your childhood. There must have been something.
Well, there was hints way after the fact, discussing these things with professionals like Bud Hopkins and Professor John Mack, and because they really, really dug hard and tried to thoroughly, because in most cases that's what it is, thoroughly, interview and investigate to see if they can come up with something like that. In my case, practically nothing, except as a child, as an infant, literally, I was like 2 or 3 years old, and my mother was extremely overprotective, and we were visiting family and friends, and it happened to be in New York City, and I was in a pretty tall building in an apartment that they lived in, and as I said, my mom had a trait of being overprotective, and I managed to disappear for, maybe an hour or an hour and a half, and I even remember bits and pieces of it, being in something I thought was a car, and, this is an odd one with the thing with time, being what I thought was an automobile, being what I thought was looking out the window as a child, but the memory of what I saw out the window was viewing the tops of buildings and the top of people's heads and the hats that they were wearing, because they were wearing clothes and hats like that in the 50s. When I was an infant. So, when I was returned, by this, and I remember clearly walking down the sidewalk and this man in a suit holding my hand, and it was like I had this attachment to this man, and then my mother came running out the door at the bottom of the building, the front entrance, crying, and where's my baby, where's my baby, and then, and I remember that trauma of her finding me, and I do remember bits and pieces of that event. But however, what's fascinating about time, and I know time travel, it's not possible, it's real. Well, of course, I know for a fact it is, because I had one experience in that. But nonetheless, in this incident, I know, even though I was an infant, I was gone a long period of time, at minimum an hour. And my mom swears, and I would say she swears to this day, because unfortunately mom passed away about 2.5 years ago, but she swore that I was only gone 2 or 3 minutes.
You know, I can believe that, because I talked to another lady who was in a car accident, and she said the ETs removed her from the scene of the accident and cured her. And it took quite a while, and they put her right back at the scene. And she said that they time traveled, or they must have, because only a few minutes had passed.
Yeah, well, it's hard to perceive or maybe conceive that time travel is possible, because
they're manipulating time, at least.
Manipulating it, absolutely, but it is. And as a matter of fact, that's the problem, in a sense, that what separates us so distinctly from I commonly, for when I'm speaking, I'm speaking in main reference to what is commonly referred to as grace.
Right.
Better than 95% of one-on-one, face-to-face experiences over 19 years now have been with that type. And it's difficult to relate or associate with beings that time travel is something as simple as us using a remote control to change channels on a television set. And so how do you share, you know, or how do you relate in that sense? However, I did have one experience where I had been pulled. I was pulled from my living room. I was wide awake, conscious. I was laying on the sofa. I was watching television, and I had gotten pulled. And the experience lasted about 2 hours. One of the many hundreds and hundreds, actually. And when I returned, and this was the one and only time this had ever happened, when I returned, it was phenomenal, because I came back 2 to 3 minutes before I left. Now, I try to stay as scientific, I try to stay as grounded, anchor and be as logical as possible throughout all these experiences. I don't let myself panic or go, and like I did in the early years when all this was new and first happening. But so I was being as observant as possible without interfering with what I was seeing. And what I saw was, prior to me being pulled, I had gotten up. This is before I got pulled. I had gotten up off the sofa. I had walked around my wet bar at the time between the living room and the kitchen. I stopped. There's a reason for me saying this. I stopped and I looked at the fish in the aquarium for a moment. I went into the kitchen. I opened up the refrigerator door, tinkered around in there, drank a little bit of a soda, put it back, took a bite of some snack or something, and then I closed the door. And then I walked back over to the sofa, and then within a moment or two is when I got pulled. Now, when I was brought back, I found myself, after the 2 hours, when I was brought back, I found myself on the sofa at where I was when I left, but I could see myself, the other self, and this is the theory with the, if you were to kill your grandfather, would you be alive today kind of thing?
Oh, okay. That's
right. I'm in panic. But I'm keeping my mouth shut, because I see myself. I got brought back the moment myself had gotten off the sofa earlier and was heading towards the kitchen. And, I mean, my heart was pounding through my chest. I was trying not to make any noise. And I was watching myself as I walked across the living room, stopped to look at the fish I had done earlier, and I was just going, I can't believe this. I can't believe this to myself. I'm seeing myself. Will myself see me? And that was my major concern was, if I made any noise or if I made it so would I startle myself, what would that be like? So it sounds 100% science fiction. However, I kept quiet. I watched myself walk through the kitchen, and fascinatingly enough, the sounds were there. I could hear the refrigerator door open. I could see the light go on in the refrigerator. I saw myself tinkering around in the refrigerator. And then I saw myself drink the soda, take a bite of something, the door shut, and now I really started getting scared, because now I knew I was going to turn around and start heading back to where I was. But here's what was fascinating, and it's opened up so many doors to the reality of going back to the past, which is, as myself came around from the kitchen to go back on the sofa, that self did not see me at all. Even though it was solid, I knew I was there. I wasn't having an out-of-body experience or anything like that. I could pinch myself, you know, slap my chest. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And my other self, as it came towards me, didn't even see me. And as that individual became within a few feet of me, he started turning transparent, and as he came like to lay in the sofa, disappeared. So I believe now I'm starting to, well, I have believed now after experiencing that over the years that I think it's not that easy to manipulate the past and make big changes in the future. And what I've later learned over the years through many abductions is that it takes a tremendous, because the energies are different when you travel back. It's on a different frequency. It's fascinating. And I'm not a scientist, but I'm trying to be as logical in science as I can. And I've learned over the years that it just takes a tremendous amount of energy to change the smallest thing in the future. So there we go with time travel.
In the future or the past, you know?
Well, you know, I believe that what I'm doing here is I'm kind of going to the beginning and towards the end, because that's where the conversation has taken us. Because all these things, you know the story, it came one at a time, one grueling step at a time.
Right.
And it's just not stuff I'm just throwing out there. But I believe that as far as the future is concerned, travel back and forth is as simple as working a remote control and watching television. I believe that quite a few of the individuals that are perceived as ETs or us, in the very distant future, we're talking perhaps maybe 10, 20, 50,000 years from now.
Would that be the Greys, or?
I would say for 90% or better of the 19 years that I've had these experiences, I had an inkling of a good part of these beings were us from the future, yes.
It would make sense, because, I mean, they seem to have the same genetics in a lot of ways. I mean, if they're interbreeding with us.
Exactly. They are creating worker beings. Now, see, I speak from a point of view, Preston, and to your listening audience, if everything there was in the world was 360 separate degrees, in 19 years I've experienced one or two of those degrees, but in pretty good detail. So the 358 that may be left are agendas that I don't even have any clue exist. But I can only speak of the ones that were in my face for many years.
Right.
And one
sure.
agenda that I know of is that there are hybrid human beings that have been created and honed and refined. But in my experience, would be for insurance purposes. Because there is a big message about the environment and what we're doing to it and the things that are in our face now.
For their insurance or for ours?
For both.
Well, we're the same then, I guess.
Yes. I like to speak in business terms, too, meaning that there's an investment in this planet. And these beings, there are other type of non-human intelligent beings out there that travel to and fro from one point A to point B, the Earth sometimes being in their path, and they stop. 99.9% of the time, they're going to be invisible. When you get glimpses of ships and so forth like that, that's because something went wrong for a few seconds and they show up.
Or if they're trying to show themselves off on purpose.
Well, there is that, too. I can't...
There seems to be a lot of that.
Well, primarily it's to intimidate leadership to, hey, we made agreements here and you're not following through, so we're going to show ourselves a little more, kind of thing. But they are slow and methodical about that.
Right.
But, they are traveling, and they have been for many years, and invisibly for the most part. But what makes it difficult for us for there to be a relationship is because there's just so many things about, and again, I'm talking about the Greys, that are similar, and then there's so many things where they're at that's just so far away.
Well, just why they come in and abduct people and scare them half to death, I mean, are they meaning to scare you, do you think? Because, I mean, you've developed a relationship with them that's, I mean, extraordinary. I've talked to many other people who've had very similar experiences as yourself, and they can build up a sort of a level of trust, and they're given more freedom of movement, and there's more communication going on. So you're getting a lot of messages.
Yeah, that's true, but it came with a price. I never have claimed to embrace alien culture. At the same time, I'm not saying that I reject it, because of the fact what took many, many, many years to start seeing things and learning things and being able to relate it to others was getting through the first 6 years of what was literally a living hell. I was traumatized. I was pulled in the middle of the night, sometimes in the middle of the day. All of this was always against my will. I was brought through what I called horrific emotional experiments, physical experiments, semen extraction. I mean, and none of this was because I wanted to. And I had more hatred, more anger, total rage, total loathing, and I did everything in my power in those first 6 years to mess them up any possible way I could. And I stayed primarily paralyzed in each abduction experience. But as it evolved and as I started to understand more the nature of what these, we can call them creatures too if you like, are like, and it took them 6 years before they would even semi let me loose a little bit, so to speak. But this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with just simple things alone just separate us so much. We're talking about minds that can transmit and receive thoughts 10 to 100 times faster than we can. So, I mean, that is intimidating itself. So, in essence, before you can even ask a question, there's an answer before you even ask it, and you knew you were about to ask it, if I'm making sense to you.
Well, yeah, but on some level they seem afraid of us. I mean, why are they exerting such, control if they're,
I believe I know where you're coming from with that. I'm going to mention, and this sounds like a pretty good opportunity to mention, what separates us from them. And why it's not likely that we're going to sit across the coffee table and sip on some coffee together with them. Because, first of all, they are thinking that much quicker. They leave zero to nothing. I should say zero to nothing. That doesn't even make sense. They leave nothing to chance. You've got minds that can comprehend things quicker and faster. And they don't play the odds games. They leave zero to nothing to chance. If there's any fragment of a possibility that there can be injury or they can be seen or they can be caught, anything close, and you could be the sweetest, nicest person in the world, which I'm a pretty decent guy. It took 6 years before I could even move around a little bit with them. Right. That just in itself keeps them separate from us. You've got beings that are 100% telepathic. I've never, ever heard them speak. So they communicate telepathically, and they communicate with us telepathically. So they're not talking. So that's just odd on our part.
Well, do you suppose they want you to remember?
Excuse me. I'm sorry?
Do they want you to remember what's happening to you? Do they want you to write this book?
For the first six years, I wasn't even permitted to. If I shared anything about the experience, then my abduction experiences were even uglier than what I just mentioned earlier with the trauma and everything they did. If I wrote anything down about it, I would be punished. Mm-hmm. Punished in a sense where there would be times that I would be pulled and I would be on board, and it always was the same room. I was always sitting on the same bench in front of this screen table thing. For 6 years, time after time after time after time, paralyzed for the most part.
That's not very nice. And I've talked to other people who've experienced the same thing. Each time they try and investigate their experience, something awful happens.
It wasn't pleasant, but see, it evolved into something really, really good. Good in the sense where one may go around and say, gee, this guy's cursed because of all the trauma he went through and all the price that was paid. And at the same token, one might say, well, hey, this guy's blessed because look at all this knowledge, he can share with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect anybody's view on what I relate to, be it positive or be it negative. And I respect it either way because I can understand. And when it's positive, that's great. If it's negative, I hold no less feelings towards those individuals because some of this is hard to swallow, or most of it, and for some people, and I understand. But, again, what separates us is They're telepathic. Their technology is completely thought activated. So totally thought activated. Things go on, things go off, and this is something that we're not. And there's another thing about them that makes it very, very difficult, and it takes a long time to get over, is that they naturally, and perhaps it could be enhanced with technology as a defense mechanism, radiate an energy that is just really unbearable. You can sense their presence, and anybody can sense their presence 50 or 100 feet away as they draw closer to you. It seems like the chemicals in our brains just dump into our body all at the same time when they start coming within a few feet of you, and your heart is racing, you're having a hard time breathing, your spine straightens up, you're paralyzed.
This is their mind power or their technology that's doing this?
You know, I think it's a natural energy, and what I've concluded with that, Preston, is that because it's an otherworldly energy. It's something not natural. It's an energy that's not from this planet and that we're not familiar with. So our body, it's like as if our body were metal and it was a giant magnet coming by, only an opposing force, if you kind of sense what I'm saying.
Right.
Whereas if you've never felt anything like that before, this is what it would do. So just being around them, and as they get closer, you're going to black out. Now, it took... but in my case, I was forced to learn to deal with that energy and that weird sensation, because I would be paralyzed. And if you can imagine that horror, I don't mean to make this sound so scary, but that's the way it was in the 80s with this. And then, of course, it evolved to something much better. But that's what I mean. They don't take chances for that 6 years. So then I learned how not to black out, not to pass out when they came close. I learned how to start controlling my breathing. And then, you know, the human body is pretty amazing. It starts adapting to things. And so that as each abduction would take place, I adapted more and more to what that sensation was and the effects it had on my body, to the point where it might only last now 5 or 8 seconds, and I know what it is. I know what to expect. I know I feel like I'm going to die. I know I'm not. I'm not going to die. I'm not going to die. I'm not going to die. And then it passes. Okay, so I just mentioned a couple of things. Now we got beings that have the technology to travel through dimensions. And a lot of travel to go from point A to point B is a pretty simple thing for these guys. And they literally use other dimensions to go through, to travel from point A to point B. See, I'm mentioning what makes it difficult to rub shoulders with them, so to speak.
Right, right.
And in these other dimensions, I should say instead of dimensions, there are other things that do exist, that do live in them, even though we can't see them with our own eyes. So even the knowledge of that separates us, in a sense, okay? And they can be in one dimension, for example, and it's all technology. Bear that in mind. And I always stuck to the logic, common sense, science the best way I could, so I can try to figure out a lot of this stuff. And they can be in one dimension and work in our dimension invisibly. So in other words, 90% of them can be in one dimension where you can't see them, and 10% of their essence is here watching, or whatever they may want to do. Now, if they need to move physical objects in our dimension, then they chance it a little bit, and perhaps 30 or 40% of their essence is in this dimension to move to do scientific things. So now we got beings that can travel dimensions. They have the ability of invisibility. The ability of invisibility.
Right.
Which
we actually have,
yeah.
We're learning how to do that technologically ourselves.
There you go.
So it's not like an impossible thing.
Exactly. So they can be invisible. Their crafts are invisible. Now, here's another thing that's pretty startling, and it sounds like, now this sounds like total science fiction, but I know they do it because they create a field. They create some kind of field that, where the laws of physics, as we understand them, no longer apply, and that's what gives them the ability to walk through walls. Now, what has happened, they can walk through a wall right into your living room if they choose to. They somehow change and create this field that does that. So, and I think sometimes when people get glimpses of this happening, they may think it's a ghost or a spirit, not to say that those things don't exist, but they actually are catching an advanced being with high technology walking through the wall.
Right.
Now, you know, so with me, I mean, just with those things in mind, it's not an easy thing to do to get to know these fellas right off the bat. and particularly when they have an agenda. So as far as social skills are concerned, they don't exist. If they have a plan in mind, they logically put it together, they intellectually put it together, they got the technology to follow through a plan, and as, unfortunately for us, as humans and what we're capable of grasping and understanding without even knowing there's a plan, that's a good one, right?
Right.
And we're subject to this stuff. They don't knock on the door and say, hi, I'm so-and-so from here, and we'd like to conduct some experiments to help you people. So they just don't operate that way.
Well, are these like the military aliens we're dealing with? I mean, you know what I mean?
Yes. I think what I've learned over the years is that when you say military, I've seen military individuals, our military individuals, interacting with these beings on several occasions in the last 19 years. So there's no doubt that there's interaction in that respect. There's no question about it. Are they the normal military? No. Do I think it's extreme black ops? Absolutely. Do I think the government at face value is even aware of this stuff? I would say that 99.9% of the government that we deal with at every level has no clue it exists. That's the reason why they deny it. I think there's a level of government that has a sort of a handle on some of this stuff, and I'm not even sure that they're even aware of the really deep black op individuals that are in constant contact and all kinds of things that are going on.
Mm.
Militaristic, in my view, also meaning that these beings are not really emotional, so they don't express feelings. They only understand emotions as they observe, and once they're out of that point, then it's not them. It's not what they are.
Well, how would you say they look at you as like a child or a pet or a lab rat or a equal?
Yeah, there were times that I used to call myself a favorite pet because I couldn't figure out. You know, why me, why me, why me, why me? You know, I mean, again, I'm average. You know, I got a couple of years of college, but nothing special. You know, I don't specialize in any area that I would think things like this would be interested in.
All right. Well, I think you answered that question in your book really well. I mean, well, they did for you, going back in time and showing all the bloodlines of your ancestry.
Exactly, exactly. Did you want me to go over that a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, for the big part of the way the system worked in those early years was on punishment reward. I was forced to learn how to convert what we would call our standard alphabet into a symbolistic form. And if I cooperated and I would go one letter at a time, which took months and months and months and months and months because I was fighting the tooth and nail, there would be what I call reward sessions, so punishment reward. If I did well, the reward session would be maybe I could play with a gizmo, or perhaps I could ask a question, and that's something about their nature to the extreme is that they don't like questions because that's one of the first things we do. You can get past all the things I was telling you about. You're going to start saying, hey, where are you from? Why are you doing this? And they've been hearing this stuff for maybe thousands of years. But I had a session where I had done extremely well, And I learned fast, as I said, if you ask a question, you're not going to get an answer. And if they do, they answer in riddles, unless they're ready to give you an answer. And I had asked, because I know I had done well during the session, that leads to what you just said to me. It was, why me? And I would scream that for years, but I knew I had done well in the session, and I knew I was going to get an answer. So the response was, first a hologram came up of what looked like a hologram, for lack of a better term. It was a way to transmit
a visual for me to see. Are you still there? Hello? Don? I think I lost you. Okay, hold on, folks, if you're listening. Hello, everybody. Sorry about the interruption. You're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and our guest tonight is Jim Sparks, author of The Keepers, An Alien Message for the Human Race. This is a book he's written about his many amazing encounters. So, as you were saying, they were teaching you an alphabet.
Right, and and I was cooperating. The sessions were based over many years in the beginning and on punishment and reward. And if I cooperated with their experiments or whatever their agenda was, then there were always reward sessions. And that I was pretty uncooperative for the most part, even when it came to the reward sessions, because I was just not where I wanted to be and I didn't want anything to do with this stuff. I didn't take advantage of it, but as it progressed and evolved, I started to, and one of them, as I was mentioning earlier, was why me? And a scene came by. I didn't know what to expect. In fact, I didn't know what to make of these scenes as they came up, and I'm going to share it with you what it went to. And the first scene was a World War II scene. It looked like I could see German, there were Nazi German officers, and I could see the Axis power allies, which were the Italian officers. And then I saw an individual that looked like myself, but that wasn't me, but like a family member from 50 years ago or so at that time, or 45 or whatever it would have been, 45, 50. That scene disappeared, and then another scene came up that looked like the late 1800s or the early 1900s, and it looked like during the period where we were becoming more mechanized and the Industrial Revolution period, and there was a factory being opened, and there was a ribbon-cutting ceremony, and I saw an individual again that had a family resemblance of myself. And I'm thinking, why are you showing me this, and why are these people, what is this, family time? You know. And then the next scene went back to, I figure, somewhere around 600 AD, 800 AD, a medieval what looked like a tavern, and there was a table, and there was several individuals with wooden mugs, and they were drinking alcoholic beverage, and one of the individuals looked like me that was drunk. And I was wearing this like hat that was almost like a hat that was pointed, and it kept flopping in my face. And then there was a scene that looked like Rome. In fact, I know it was Rome, and it looked like the Senate, and I'm not saying I had held some seat in the Senate or anything like that, but I was at least one of the audience, maybe representing the people in some respect, and I saw a family resemblance there. But the last scene, here's how the why me got answered, and this is just how they did it, was, and I didn't like it, which was these ape-like looking creatures, but they weren't, they looked like a cross between an ape or a monkey, so to speak, and us. They were foraging on the ground, they were foraging in the trees. And thankfully, I didn't see any of them that looked like myself, but the telepathic message at that point was that we genetically manipulated your genes to make you or us who we are from them, and we track a particular family line, for lack of a better way to explain it, or a gene tracking, different lines. And, of course, that made me, extremely angry. I yelled, there's no way you can convince me that, you know, you're a reason why we're here. Bottom line is, accept it or don't accept it. I don't blame you if you don't, and it's wonderful if you do, that they do follow particular family lines, and they have been following them for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. So why me means a meaning that I came from some particular line. And unbeknownst to me, you know, I came up again in their agenda from a family line.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the few things that UFO researchers do agree upon, is that it does run in families, and there's several cases that people are tracing back five generations or more. So
Yeah, that's kind of stuff that come out. You know, again, I wasn't into the study in it, and of course now as the years went on, I started finding. I heard about MUFON, then I heard about abductee support groups, and then you know, these facts started to present themselves, and they all related to it. So yeah, that's true.
Now they have done some good things for you. I mean, like they gave you a gift of healing on a couple of occasions.
Yes.
Could you describe that?
I think one in particular. I guess it phenomenalized is not the word, but I was just mesmerized by it. I can't say that it was something that went on all the time, but I had been pulled, and as you mentioned and I mentioned earlier, that my recall is 90%, 95%, but I do have blackout periods, and then for whatever reason they black me out sporadically from time to time, and there was a time that I was pulled, and I had they had put me unconscious. But I started to come to during the middle of what I didn't understand was at the time, which was a procedure. And I was smelling this, like, mucus smell, and I was on a gurney, and the mucus smell was, like, coming from, like, it was coming, like, a vapor was coming out of my lungs, and it was coming through my, into my sinuses and out my nose, and so as I was breathing, it was a horrible smell. And I that part of the procedure I remember, but I had no clue what was going on. And when it was over and I was conscious again, I was in a room, and this is during the periods where they were allowing me to start moving around. So it was always in the same room. I was in the same room on board for years, small room. But I was standing up. I was leaning up against the table and near the bench that I had sat on for at least 6 years straight with all these abductions. After the procedure, not knowing why I was standing there and what was going on, two of the grays walked into the room from a corridor. And now this was like a first time because I was partially paralyzed. I had some mobility, but it was slow. And they were walking up to me, and they had this perfectly square black box in their hands. And here's their hands with their skinny fingers and I didn't want to look at their eyes, so I was looking at the ground. I'd look up at them, and I would look down at the floor, and I would look up at them, and they were walking closer and closer, and they took the box, and the whole thing was so new, like, I'm not paralyzed, I'm not on this bench, and what is this box? And they slid it with their bony fingers across the box, and then telepathically said, it's a gift. And I went, a gift? What do you mean a gift? And they go, it's a gift. It's a gift for you. And they say, I never heard any expression of kindness. This is when things started to change. And I said, what do you want me to do with it? So what do I do with this? There's a box sitting on the table. And they go, do with it. The words were telepathically, I'll never forget, do with it as you will. And then he turned around and they walked out. Now I'm standing in this room and I'm looking at this box on the table and I'm thinking, well, what am I supposed to do? And I walked up to it, and I didn't want to touch it. I was afraid of it at first, and I was looking at it, and I got closer, and it wasn't shiny. It was a black absorbent black. It was perfectly squared, and then I touched it with my forefinger, and it didn't hurt me. And then I picked it up, and I started handling it, and I was turning it in every direction. I was looking at it from all sides, and I am I supposed to open this thing? So I started prying on it. First, I put my, you know, put my left hand on the bottom and my hand on the top, and I started pulling with all my strength, and it wouldn't do anything. And then I took it, and that was me. I was pretty crude, always was with them. And I took, you know, wedged it between my feet, you know, and I'm trying to open this thing, and it wouldn't open. And then I grabbed it, and I was going to smash it on the table. And then I thought to myself, no, man, you know what? You've got some freedom here for one of the first times. Why make it sound like you're tearing up their ship? Yeah, the first time you let them loose and you're going to start tearing things up, okay? So then the thought came to me, and I know it didn't come from me, was you didn't try and open it gently. So I took my right hand and my left hand under it, and I just, with minimal pressure, just pulled slightly, and it opened up. And when I looked inside, right at the same time, this horrific, horrible odor just came out of this thing. And there was this dark brown, horrible-looking, tarry fluid filling up about 3 or 4 inches in this box. And there was these, like, glass tubes stuck in them. And I pulled it back from my face, and I said, what the hell is this? What kind of gift is this? You know, I yelled it out in the thing. And they came back and they said, it's your gift. We extracted it from your lungs. Mm-hmm. Well, I was an extremely heavy smoker. So they had used their medical technology to extract the tar and the garbage and everything from my lungs. So that was a medical procedure that I'll never forget.
See, it's amazing. I mean, they do have some care. I mean, I don't know if they're just treating you as they would, you know, keeping their pets healthy, but if they've recommended you not to eat meat as well.
Yeah, and I went through a period of it was don't eat land animals. It was kind of specific. So fish and chicken were okay. And I went through, I actually was extremely resistant to it because, and I've always, you know, liked my ribs and my steak and my hamburgers and they were nudging me that way. That was something they weren't real strong, like, you should not do this or anything like that. It's like there was this constant reminder, you're eating too much. See, and I thought what they were saying was, don't eat it at all. So I finally, after several years of that and not getting the message, I had an experience where they showed me, again, in like a hologram situation, and I was with a pet I had at the time. It was a dog of mine. His name was Tucker. In fact, his picture's in the back of the book. And I turned cannibalistic on my dog in this hologram. I don't mean to sound gross, but it was like I was starving somewhere, and eating the flesh of that animal would be like that mammal would be like me eating what the cow would be or something. So I got the message, and for several years I just stuck with chicken and fish. And I almost instantly felt better within like the first few weeks. The food was easy to digest. I had more energy. And now I've allowed some red meat back into my diet, and I haven't heard anything from them about it. So, but it certainly got me off the track of just devouring that, you know, every day, three times a day or two times a day.
It's funny because I've heard that same advice given to other abductees or whatever you want to call yourself. I don't know if that's the term you like to use.
Haven't found the word for it. Really haven't, you know. The closest thing has been detainee, but you know these interactions evolved. My chief complaint was as they became a little more trusting of me, and because all I wanted to do was kill them. And it's kind of a funny thing that I said at one point that I enjoyed and I remember to this day was, turn me loose and I'll squeeze your fat heads off your skinny little necks. and that's just the way I felt. So if you can imagine the hatred and the animosity. But as the years progressed, and there was something that took place that changed all of that, which was I had made up my mind that I was going to kill an alien, that no matter what, under any and all circumstances, if I ever got any opportunity, I was going to kill an alien. That's how hateful I was in those early years. And there was an occasion where I was in my living room, and I was being pulled constantly. As you can imagine, with family and friends and things of that nature, they thought Jim lost his mind. I learned, though, don't talk about it, don't say anything, and everybody thinks you're fine. But as the years progressed and more of this stuff started coming out, then my friends and family came around to, hey, Jim's always been honest, straight, logical, and he's obviously going through this stuff. But nonetheless, I was in my living room, and I guess I was just weird and special for me in these experiences because all the memories are there, almost all. And from time to time, they would come into the home and in their usual fashion, which would be to walk through the walls. And on one particular evening, I was just so bound and determined to nab one of them that a week before, something like that, as I recall, I went and bought a 357 Magnum, and I bought all the bullets for it, and I had it next to my easy chair on the table. And that particular night, I had gotten myself a fifth of a vodka, and so with a fifth of vodka in my left hand, and I was swigging it straight from the bottle, which I, you know, never drank like that, but I was getting up my courage in the event that perhaps this would be an evening that they would do a home thing. They would come into my house a lot and just look at stuff, and bump into stuff, like to see how the monkey lived in his natural environment, so to speak.
Wow.
But on that particular night, they did come, and I had the bottle in my left hand, and as they were coming in, I picked up the pistol, and I cocked the pistol, and there was two of them. And one was wandering around in the living room, and the other one came right in front of me. And I took another swig of the bottle, and they just had no fear of this pistol and me sitting there. holding it on them, and walked up to the television and was like fumbling with it, not like trying to turn, I don't know what he was doing. And I yelled something out because the alcohol had hit me at that point, like, oh, you guys come from a godzillion miles and you're so smart, but you're so stupid you can't even figure out how to turn on a TV. I'm going to kill you. And I just couldn't pull the trigger. I just couldn't do it. I had my finger on the trigger. I was it. You know, this is all the years. Here's my opportunity. I'm going to kill one. I can show it to everybody.
Well, they must have known that on some level.
They did, because there were experiments that took place that kind of led to that. And then the telepathic message was, we know you're not a killer. And I, you know, I laid the pistol down and I started weeping like a baby, like, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, I can't believe I'm not doing this. But that was the experience that led to the mass abduction, where lots and lots and lots of people were on board a ship, and that's where they an environmental lesson was given. So this stuff was leading. This was all leading to something. It was leading in a way that we normally wouldn't proceed, and it was this business for sparing the planet. Well, we all got environmental lessons on that mass abduction. I guess that's the best way for me to surmise it.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. I mean, Thomas Bullard, he did a study, he's a folklorist, he did a study of 330-some cases of people who have been taken on board and found that the most common experience was an examination, but the second most common experience was warnings of ecological and environmental disaster and collapse and things like this.
That really just, that just astounds me. Who is this?
Thomas Bullard.
Forgive me for lack of experience with probably some of the best researchers and cutting-edge researchers on the planet, because I purposely sever or cut myself off from reading as much material as possible or even watching movies. So I don't want to find similarities that might cloud my experiences. So
well, I'm glad you didn't, because it really makes reading your book a real treat. I mean, like the Phoenix symbolism that you mentioned is present in other cases as well.
Well, that's another thing. See, even to this day, if you like what you're saying to me, is because you may relate something to myself. That was an unusual one. I'm wondering where I should go. Should I go with the environmental lesson on or the Phoenix? What do you think?
Well, we should probably wrap it up pretty soon, so let's go with the main message that the ETs, I think, are trying to get across.
Okay. How many moments do we have here so I can kind of know how...
Five minutes, and okay. We can go for another, I mean, 15 minutes
fine.
If you want.
But no, five is good. All of this led up to, well, not, this wasn't the finality of it, but the main message. And, you know, a lot of the things, you know, may sound a little corny here, but, you know, corny and truth, for the most part, can be very the same thing, okay? If it doesn't sound, you know what I'm saying?
Well, sure.
But in this experience, I got pulled, I found myself in a clearing in the woods, I'd say extremely large clearing, at least the size of a football field, but totally surrounded by trees, and you can just tell that they just obliterated the trees, and here's this clearing, and I was standing up, and below me was around a dozen people in a pile that had gotten abducted, and they were mostly nude or in their night clothes. They were paralyzed for the most part. There was another group of people to my left, about a dozen or 15 in a pile. I hate to put it that way, but that's the way it looked and the way it was. And then to the left of them was another dozen or 15 people.
And where do you suppose what this was?
I, you know, for years, and I think I feel comfortable saying it, I tried to figure out where I was and I think I got a pretty good handle because it was an overcast evening. The trees were the type of pine trees that you would see between southern and central Florida, more on the west, towards the west coast and some of the isolated areas out there. And it happened that when I did check the weather that next morning after that experience, it so happened that the bulk of the country happened to be clear, and where the overcast stuff was I don't know if you're familiar with Lake Okeechobee in Florida.
Sure.
But at the center of the state, south to the tip of the state, was overcast, and the rest of the country was pretty much clear. And the pine trees that I had seen in the clearing told me I was somewhere in north or west central Florida.
Okay.
And there was this clearing, and I was mesmerized by the mere fact that I was totally 100% non-paralyzed. I was standing there, and not only was I able to move around, but I had my faculties about me and physically could move around, but I wasn't on board in this room. I was outside, so I was pulled and I was outside somewhere. Now, I had many experiences down the road where in facilities and stuff like that, but this was one of the first ones where I was free and I could move. And to the left, I'm kind of shortening this thing,
right, but
to the left, you know, I can give all the details on it. On the left, to our horizon, three blobs, there were three glowing lights, and they looked like those million candle things that they advertise for new cars or a shopping center above the clouds. So they were just glowing, and one of them just zoomed across the sky above myself and my pile of people. I say mine because I was standing with them. Another to the second pile, and then another over the third pile instantly. So what they had done was they had pulled several dozen people from God knows where and kind of took them to this clearing in the woods. How they got there exactly is because I only, after being pulled, came conscious when I was standing there amongst them. And then descending from the clouds was my first visual of the out or the exterior of a ship. And it, to me, being able to move and look up at that thing was probably the most drop-dead gorgeous sight that I had ever seen. It lowered itself. The second one came below the clouds. The third one, bright white light came out of the bottom with a hue of blue, and then I blacked out. When I found myself too, now I'm going for, I was asked telepathically to lead all these people that were on the ground were now all standing, and we were in kind of a corridor, and I was asked to lead them, into this what opened up to be this huge room or auditorium-like looking thing with rows and rows and rows and rows and rows of monitors. See, this is where they're getting their environmental messages. And I know these people consciously may not remember it, but later it'll come to them. But, we were sat, and because I'm skipping through some things to get to the point.
Right.
Am I doing okay with this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm following.
All right. We were, because I was asked to help seat people, and it was one of the most exciting things to me was the fact that I call that I got a job. Now, you can call it the Helsinki syndrome where, you know, you've got your captives for all these years and you think they're nice guys because they're giving you little freedoms.
Right.
Call it what you might or what you may, but I was excited over the fact that I could move around and I could be a part of something. I didn't see anything that was being harmful done. After everybody was seated, and I'll skip through how that went, these monitors all lit up at the same time. Now, this room was holding many, 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 many more people than what was on the ground before me. And before we had gone up there, and it was huge inside there, and it looked nothing like the size of the ship. So here we go with this, you know, dimension, you know, quirk thing.
Right.
And when the monitors lit up, the first scene on there was, and they had our emotions enhanced dramatically, our senses enhanced dramatically, how we respond to stimuli was extremely enhanced and powerful. And the first image that came up on the screen was this beautiful, just beautiful, drop-dead gorgeous scene of the ocean. The colors were more vivid than I had ever seen in my life. The blue was blue, the turquoise was more turquoise, the sky was beautiful, and it was teeming with fish,
wow,
fresh and alive. And that's exactly what you did, Preston. You just went, wow, I can't believe this.
Huh.
This is beautiful. And then that scene would disappear, and another scene would be that of like a mountain, a forest scene with beautiful, healthy trees and beautiful blue sky in the background and just taking your breath away and then just mesmerized by it, just, you know, 10 to 100 times more the stimuli of normal beauty, if I'm making sense.
Right, yeah.
And then it just takes your breath away. And then another scene with mountains and snow on the top, and it was just one beautiful scene after the other. And all these monitors, for lack of a better term, I call them monitors, they were things that was like a screen, were playing or showing, I should say, the same thing at the same time. And all these people were sitting there just mesmerized by all this stuff. And then the scenes, unfortunately, slowly started to turn ugly. I just didn't know. I didn't expect what I was seeing. I didn't know why I was seeing what I was seeing. But the beautiful blue water and sky with the fish, the water was brown and murky, and the fish were bloated and floating on the top, dead. And you just went, it was the reverse sensation. You just went, oh, God, no.
Wow.
And then the next scene was where you would see everything was just so filled with extreme emotion from just being so elated, then to seeing these things that you just wanted to die. Again, they were enhancing your sensation fit for the impact of what was about to be said, and I'm about to say it. The next scene was where they showed the trees. They were all acid-eaten on the top, and the sky was nasty and polluted, and one after the other, just horrible, and you just went, no. No, I didn't even want to see. I don't want to see this anymore. And then the telepathic message to everybody was, as each scene went on, you're killing your planet. Your planet is dying. You're killing your planet. So your planet is dying. Go ahead.
Is this going to happen then? I mean, do they think that this is inevitable?
Well, I can end it with you on this note, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I was horrified by it. I know that everybody, that all these people that were involved with it, and who knows, they might have been doing 100 of these abductions a night for all I know in North America. They could have been doing tens of thousands all across the globe for all I know. And happily, there's just much more of an awareness about the condition of the planet. And this stuff started in the early 90s to mid-90s that I'm referring to, and it has progressed even more powerful. And when I turn on the national television and I see things, and I see there's just much more awareness of the global warming, the rainforest, and things of that nature, my assignment was the rainforest. Now, not that there's anything I can do, but I seem to be able to get this message out, and people are hearing. Just think, we're talking now, and you have an audience. The message was, and I'm going to say something that's a little sad, then I'm going to say something that's extremely positive. At that time, we were told that we had approximately 5 to 7 years to turn things around where we could make it where almost everything that we had messed up could be back again. Am I making sense?
Right.
And this ate me up because year after year I formed a foundation called Your Earth. I had very little money to operate with, even though I had a business. My mere tens of thousands and whatever what I had to do relative to really get something like that going was difficult. And as each year went on, I was just getting more and more horrified by the fact that, oh, God, now we're in the sixth year, now we're in the seventh year, and now I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're past the seventh year. What does this mean? Does this mean we're going to die? No. What it meant was to bring it back to almost the pristine place that it was. So as, in other words, we still have plenty of time. Well, plenty meaning in measure of years, not decades and centuries and such. To slow it down, to turn it around, and never possibly get it back to as healthy as she once was, when I mean she, the planet.
Right.
But at least stop the majority of the damage and bring a lot of it back. So what every passing hour, every passing day, every passing week, and every passing month, I fear that now we just lose more and more and more that can never be returned. But take heart, what I mean by the good news is it certainly isn't too late.
Well, I think things are beginning to turn around.
I think you're right. I'm seeing things that are extremely possible. And it amazes me. And it's on a global basis. And because during when these things were happening, and I'm talking about in the 90s and so forth, yes, there was an awareness of the environment, and all these things were brought to our attention, so to speak. But now I'm seeing things where, I mean, the whole globe is concerned and wants to move on it. So
right.
I don't think that's by accident, my friend.
I don't think so. Well, I have just one last question I have to ask you. Do you think that the ETs are going to be showing themselves officially or more publicly, or is there going to be an escalation of activity? Or?
Well, the nature of the being is this. From my 2 degrees in the 360-degree circumference,
right.
Is that they And I don't know if it's going to sound like yes or if it's going to sound like no. They go out of their way to non-interference, non-showing themselves at all costs. And I feel, now I could be way off on this, because again, I can only look at what I see. I feel that, but I'll say something that's going to reflect more of a yes than a no in a moment, but I feel that probably they're more in our face, so to speak, and there's more sightings, and there's these abductions, and people having memories, and people like me, because of the fact that they have an investment in this planet, be it for natural resources, be it for whatever their reasons are, that the few that I do know and most that I don't. And the only reason we're seeing what we're seeing now is only because of the condition that the place is in. So it's like a pasture, and I don't want to refer to ourselves as cows or cattle, but it's like, you know, they're the farmers, they're the ranchers, this is the pasture. And so the farmer is going to be more prevalent, or the rancher on the ranch, and be more in the cattle's face if he or she sees a disease.
Okay.
Or something's wrong with the pasture, or something has to be squared away. And so they're more, less hiding, whatever it takes to get the job done. I'm afraid in one aspect, the more of them we see, and the more they're present, that tells me that not enough is being done, if I'm making sense to
you. Right, it's worse, or worse off then.
But on a positive note, Preston, I know if you read the work and how I wrote the work, I really go out into detail to the best of my ability so that you know what I'm talking about, how all these things unfolded, you know, and so I know I'm going from like a beginning to an end or to the middle, so to speak. But in the latter years here, and that's where this has evolved, if I have had encounters with near-future human beings, and we're only talking about several hundred to maybe 1,000 years out there, well, to me, that's a very good sign.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Then we're still around.
Well, if you want, excuse me. Sorry about that. If you want, let me take a little sip of water. I think on a cautious note, yes, we do come back, but how many of us survive before it's at that point is still unknown to me. So we got work to do.
All right. Well, it should be exciting times, to say the least.
Well, thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Jim, for coming on the show. Your book is amazing. I read it one time full through, and I'm halfway through the second time.
And, thanks. That's great.
It's really an eye-opening book. It's filled with illustrations for all you out there who are going to buy this book. It's fully illustrated, and it's quite a long book, too, 230-240 pages. So it's really an excellent book, and I really want to thank you for writing it and coming forward, because you didn't have to, and I know there's lots of people like you who haven't come forward.
Well, thank you for making me feel good about it, and it's deeply appreciated.
Oh, thank you very much. All right, well, that's our show tonight. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. Our guest has been Jim Sparks, author of The Keepers, An Alien Message for the Human Race. If you're at all interested in UFOs or ETs or the future of our planet, you really, really have to read this book, because it has definitely some amazing answers in it. So I want to thank you all, and I hope you all enjoyed the show, and you can join us next week when my guest is Elaine Kuzmeskis, and we will be talking about Connecticut ghosts. So thank you, and have a great evening.